Lecture 12. Campaigns of the Delian League.
Welcome back. We must return now to the years of fighting, the year 479 BC, that year after Salamis, when the Greeks finished their mopping up operations on land and sea against the Persians, and when, by all rights, the Great War should have been over, since Xerxes showed no signs of marshaling his vast forces again for another attempt to conquer Greece. But the fly in the ointment of peace and stability were these Ionian Greeks, these Greeks of Asia and the Aegean Islands. They saw now a chance to ensure their permanent freedom from the great king if only they could get the sworn protection of the mainland Greeks. And having been rebuffed by the Spartans, initially at Mycale, Leotychidas telling them that they lived too far away to be protected by the Spartans, they should in fact pick up and move to Greece. The Spartan plan was to clear out some of the Medizing cities like Thebes and turn their territories over to these Ionian Greeks just so they wouldn't be so far away and difficult to defend. The Ionians did not like that idea, and Xanthippus the Athenian sprang to their defense and said it was wrong that they should have to abandon their cities. The war had been partly fought for their freedom. Every effort should be made so that they could stay where they belonged, their traditional homelands. So the Athenians began to shine as the great hope of the Ionians, and in the following year, 478 BC, when Aristides the Just, the Athenian hero who had led the Athenian troops at Plataea, he came out with the fleet this time. He was at Byzantium. The Spartans, who are still very concerned that they may be losing their role as the great leaders of all the Greeks, they're a bit like Aesop's dog in the manger. They don't particularly want to be tied to distant campaigns, but they darn well don't want anyone else to have the prestige of being leaders in their place, least of all the Athenians. They have sent out Pausanias, the regent, the man who masterminded the Greek victory at Plataea over Mardonius' army. And away from Sparta, Pausanias goes bad. He is involved in corruption scandals. He's brutally tyrannical to the other allies, very high-handed and acting the part of almost an oriental potentate, and not to be trusted. He scorns them. He does not let them into his confidence. And finally, there's an open break with the Spartans, and the Ionians go to Aristides the Just, who's there with the Athenian contingent of ships at Byzantium, and virtually force themselves on him as allies. They ask Athens to be to them what Sparta has been to the traditional Peloponnesian League and the Hellenic League that fought the Persians and met at the Isthmus of Corinth. They ask Athens to be what the Greeks called their hegemon, their war leader. And this will elevate Athens, which will now have a league of its own, to borrow our American phrase, elevate Athens to a position of equality with Sparta. And Aristides, whose own incorruptibility of character, whose own reputation, whose own fairness and openness, has in part brought the Ionians over to the Athenian side, he agrees. So they go to the island of Delos, and they meet there, and they create a new league, which we in modern times call the Delian League, but they never called it that in ancient times. It was always the Athenians and their allies. Who were the allies? The cities and islands that initially wanted protection from reconquest by the Persians and who turned to Athens for help. Athens itself had been elevated, just as Themistocles hoped it would be, from that second-class rank that it had occupied before the Persian Wars, a city with no distinguished monuments or creative artists or philosophers or geniuses of any kind. It had been elevated to a sort of first-rank position in the Greek world, thanks to its energy, thanks to its willingness to take risk. And now the payoff seemed to be this wonderful surge of interest in Athens as a leader on the part of these Ionians. So Aristides met with the representatives of these cities and islands. They met on Delos, and they picked Delos because it was a traditional family reunion place of all the Ionian peoples, and that included Athens on the west side of the Aegean, and all those cities on the Asiatic mainland and the islands on the east side. They had traditionally, for centuries, every year in earliest spring, when the sea lanes opened again for navigation, these Ionians would meet on the island of Delos, and they would celebrate their ancestral god Apollo, who was believed to be the father of the entire Ionian race of Greeks through his son Ion. There's a wonderful picture of these Ionian family reunions on Delos. It comes to us from a hymn that the ancients said was written by Homer. Modern scholars think it was written by a follower of Homer. It's a hymn to Apollo, and I want to share with you a little passage from this where this early poet, he's probably writing in the 7th century BC, is describing what it's like to be on Delos when to this barren island with its temple to Apollo and its sacred palm tree, it's supposed to be the island where Apollo and his sister Artemis were actually born, they're suddenly come as the sea lanes open and the winter is past, all these ships from east and west bearing the Ionians to the great festival. You, Apollo, you rejoice above everything else in your heart for Delos, where Ionians in their trailing robes gather with their children and their wives. They remember you, they gladden you with contests of boxing, singing, and dancing. Yeah, it's a very strange part of the Greek religious ethos that one way to worship the gods is have a race or hold a competition. But this is part of that Homeric world also. Anyone who came upon this gathering of Ionians would liken them to immortal gods. He would see the happiness of them all, and he would delight at the sight of the men, the women with their beautiful girdles, the swift ships, and the many possessions. So this lovely snapshot of an Ionian reunion was something that was held in the hearts of all these people as a beautiful annual ceremony that brought together distant clans, allowed them to share their feeling of common ancestry, and now, with the Delian League founded on Delos, a sense of common purpose. What was the mission stated for this league, founded in the year 478 BC? The mission was to punish Persia perpetually for having dared to invade Greece and burn the temples at Athens, for having dared to enslave the Ionians of Asia. Persia would be a target forever. This was a war that would never end, a war of reprisal. And they knew that they would collect booty and loot from that war. They would have a treasury on the island of Delos under the guardianship of the god Apollo. There that treasure would be kept. They knew that it would cost money to run the war. And this is a great difference between naval wars and hoplite infantry wars. On land, every hoplite is a man of property. He owns his own armor. He brings his own food for the campaign. It costs a city virtually nothing to put on a hoplite war. Navies are completely different. There's tremendous investment in the ships. There's an even bigger ongoing cost of keeping the ships maintained. There's a wretched little mollusk called the teredo worm or shipworm, we call them in English, but it's not really a worm, that in warm waters like the Mediterranean will burrow into the timber of ships and riddle them with holes, and after a very short time, they become unseaworthy unless they are very carefully maintained, cared for, drawn up out of the water, loose or teredo-ridden planks pulled out and replaced by other planks. This costs money. And you also have to train your crews. And a navy can't be suddenly pulled together in the same way that the trumpeter standing in the marketplace can pull together a hoplite phalanx. There's maneuvers to practice, as we saw at Lade with that Phocaean leader, Dionysius. You can't just stand in the line, be brave, and win a battle. So for all these reasons, they needed contributions from the allies, and the allies were all happy to contribute. They, after all, had been paying tribute to Persia, and Aristides commanded so much of their admiration that they agreed that he would set the tribute levels for every ally. He basically took the Persian standard as his own, but he said, you can pay your tribute in money, in ships, or in men. These are the three ways, and many of them initially sent contributions of ships and men. They wanted to take part actively in this ongoing war against Persia. At the time that it began, the Delian League did not include all of the Greek cities of the East. Many of them were still in Persian hands, and it was going to be part of the ongoing campaigns every year to liberate those cities. Nonetheless, a lot of the campaigns just looked like buccaneering pirate raids, where this amphibious expedition would set out in their ships, they'd come to an unsuspecting shore held by the Persians, spill off the ships onto the land, gather up all the loot that they could, everything from cattle to family treasures, and haul them off back to Delos, distribute them among the allies who had taken part, and add the surplus to the treasury on Delos. Aristides did not himself go on to lead the League. I always think of him as sort of a Moses-like figure who had this vision of a unified Ionian world led by Athens, but did not pass over into it as leader. Instead, the leadership was up for grabs. One of the men who's still around in Athens and is wanting to get back into a position of prominence is that great leader Themistocles, who was the one who originally had the idea of using the silver from the silver strike in about 483 to build the ships. He'd always had a naval policy. Even before the Battle of Marathon, he had told the Athenians they should turn to the sea, that line of his that I quoted before and that he quoted more than once. It was sort of his motto, "I do not know how to play a lyre or tune a harp, but I know how to make a small city great." That knowing how was naval power. That was what could make a city great. Back in 493 BC, when he was the archon, the chief magistrate of Athens, he'd used his prominence and his influence to get the Athenians to start to fortify and develop a promontory 4.5 miles from Athens. Athens is a slightly inland city, a promontory stretching out into the sea called the Piraeus, which had 3 natural harbors, was very rocky and waterless, so that they hadn't built a city there previously. But he got them to build some walls. They'd given up after Marathon. Piraeus was sitting there as a half-finished fortification at the time that Xerxes came with his invasion. But now Themistocles got them back in the groove. They finished the walls of Piraeus. They hired the world's first known city planner, a strange fellow named Hippodamus of Miletus, who reminds me very much of Frank Lloyd Wright. He dressed in an unusual way. He had wild and outlandish theories about relative Pythagorean ratios between the widths of alleys and side streets and main boulevards, how big the blocks should be. He believed that cities should be laid out on a grid, rationally, scientifically. There were a lot of ancient people who thought this was a terrible way to lay out a city, but because it meant that if enemies got inside your walls, they could find their way around without getting lost. They preferred that old, winding, twisting, organic series of circular alleys that remind us of a sort of a bazaar in a Middle Eastern city today, where only the locals knew how to get anywhere, and if invaders came in, they would be easily lost and rounded up again. But nonetheless, Hippodamus believed in this. He believed in using the winds that prevailed in the area so that they would blow through the streets if the streets were oriented in the correct direction to the prevailing winds and bring fresh air, that the sunshine and its slanting rays in winter or summer would somehow be harnessed in order to keep the houses as cool as possible in summer, as warm as possible in winter. He was a great thinker, a very inspiring fellow, and he laid out a new city at the Piraeus, which developed in time to almost be a rival of Athens itself. So Piraeus is now the headquarters of the Athenian fleet, thanks to Themistocles. And Themistocles went on with some other projects. He got Athens re-walled in spite of Spartan opposition. He used his stratagems for that. And he is, in general, trying to put himself forward again as the great leader, the great visionary of Athens. But he's got too many enemies. He's rubbed too many people the wrong way. He doesn't have any political friends at all. He's outside the circle of Athenian old aristocratic families, and his reputation is tarnished. He came into this whole Persian War period a man of very modest means, and he wanted to use the wars to get rich. And he did so through some misappropriation of funds, some embezzlement, some taking of bribes from foreigners. We have a long poem by one angry person who paid Themistocles a bribe so that he would be reinstated in his city after the Persian Wars, and Themistocles didn't follow through, although he pocketed the money. So we get this very angry rant about how terrible Themistocles is. Lots of people agreed with that, and he was eventually exiled from Athens. A price was put on his head. He was declared a criminal for various crimes, probably some of them true and some of them trumped up charges. And Athens now had a very long arm. It could reach anywhere in the Greek world. He couldn't hide out with his friends in other cities. He eventually, irony of ironies, turned to the only safe place he could find, Persia. He went to the coast of Asia Minor, evading Athenian and Delian League squadrons on the way, and surrendered himself to Xerxes. Spent a year on the coast learning Persian so that he could do his own diplomacy without interpreters. Then, by the time he went up to the court, it appears possible that Xerxes had died and his son, Artaxerxes, had taken over. At any rate, the great king, whether Xerxes or his son, received Themistocles, probably regarded Themistocles as a great trophy to have on his side now, recognized him as a man of capabilities, and gave him three cities on the coast of Asia Minor, three Greek cities that he would govern, Magnesia on the Maeander, Myus, and Lampsacos up on the Hellespont. So he's now got a little fiefdom of his own, and he's behaving like a Persian provincial governor for the rest of his life. And he was very popular in those cities, and they raised monuments to him in their marketplaces and put his image on their coins long after his death. But that was the sad end of the man who saved Greece through his cunning. It's a striking thing to remember that when Themistocles was a boy, his father, Neocles, took him walking along the shore at Athens and pointed out the rotting hulks of some of the city's old triremes from the days before the big shipbuilding effort, abandoned there on the coast. And Neocles said to his son, Themistocles, "Don't go into politics. You see how the Athenians treat their leaders when they have no further use for them." But Themistocles paid no attention, and it was his father who turned out to have some insights into how democracies behave when their leaders, no matter what services they have performed, have lost the gloss of newness and current popularity. They are quickly cast aside. Who emerged as Themistocles' star was in the decline? The son of the hero of Marathon, that general Miltiades, who had led the run of a mile across the plain at Marathon that defeated the Persian expeditionary force of 490 BC. This son's name was Cimon, sometimes spelled in the Latin way, C-I-M-O-N, in the Greek with a kappa, K-I-M-O-N. Cimon was everything Themistocles was not. He was born so rich that he was able to be the most generous and open-handed man in all of Athens. He had a fine crop of ruddy hair and a handsome, open-hearted manner, popular with everyone, friends everywhere, all the accomplishments of a perfect gentleman because he'd been brought up as a true aristocrat in his father's house, and brought up not at Athens, but up there on the Hellespont in the family fiefdom in the Gallipoli Peninsula opposite Troy, back before the Persian Wars. So not only did he have that outside Athens experience, that Asiatic experience growing up, looking across the Hellespont to Asia and talking to people from there, his mother was a Thracian princess. Miltiades, spending so many years from Athens, had met a king of Thrace, had fallen in love with the king's daughter and married her, and Cimon was the son of that union. So he's not a typical Athenian at all. He's a very charismatic, very glamorous sort of figure with a tremendous drive for naval affairs and military matters. He emerges in the very first campaigning season of the Delian League as their new general. And under him, every year the League goes out campaigning. The fleet marshals at Delos or whatever place they have agreed to muster, and Cimon leads them into some new campaign, taking a city, making war in a Persian-held area, or just raiding and coming back home loaded with spoils. I'd like to share with you the first year's campaign just to give you an idea of the kind of activities of the Delian League and how they kept their treasury filled with all of the loot. They went north from Delos in that first year to the river Strymon in what they called Thrace, the river that came down out of the gold mining region around Mount Pangaeon, and attacked a little town called Aeon, E-I-O-N, still held by Persians, still loyal to the great king, and under the rule of a Persian governor or military leader named Boudes. And Boudes was there with his wife and his children, fanatically loyal to Xerxes, the great king. They only had mud brick walls around the town, but this was a period which had not yet developed, as the Hellenistic world and the Roman world would, great siege machinery for breaking down walls. So the defensive armament of cities was much greater than the ability of armies to break through it. And behind those walls, the people of Aeon sat, feeling secure against Cimon. Well, Cimon was the son of Miltiades. Miltiades, you remember, had known great King Darius, had spent time with the Persians, had seen their great engineering works. Cimon took a leaf from the Persian book. He diverted the river Strymon, so instead of flowing in its bed past the town of Aon, it now flowed straight at those mud brick walls and eventually washed them away so that there was a huge breach in the city where the river had eaten away at the mud brick. And as Boges, the Persian commander, saw what was happening, he went up, apparently by night, the Greeks didn't know he'd done it, and dumped all the treasure of the city into the river, which Cimon had brought over to flow against the walls, so it would be lost in the silt and lost to the Athenians. He then built a great funeral pyre. He, his wife, and children got up on the funeral pyre, had it set alight, and went up as a sort of a holocaust offering to their loyalty to Xerxes. And part of the city caught fire and burned along with them. Then the people who were hoping to save themselves went up on the walls, signaled that they were surrendering. Cimon took it over. He shared the loot with the allies, but he made that mining district to which Aeon and the Strymon were the key property of Athens. And Athens then, thanks to Cimon's success there, sent out colonists and created new communities, Athenian colonies, so that they would control the mining district of Thrace. And the man who will succeed Herodotus as the Greek world's next great historian, Thucydides, was tied into Cimon's family. He belongs to a younger generation, but he had Thracian ancestors and Athenian ancestors. Where did Thucydides get his money? The gold mines of Thrace that came into the Athenian world at this moment, as the Athenians used the leverage of the Delian League to expand their own territory. And where did he spend his own exile? Thucydides, during the time of the Peloponnesian War, which he chronicled up there in Thrace, looking after the family gold mines. So Cimon is using the League to expand Athens' horizons. Now, Cimon felt that, he certainly knew that the Athenians were sort of standing a little bit below the Persians in a morale sense, and that for all the Persians, wars were holy wars. Ahura Mazda is the god of light. They are fighting as sons of light against the powers of darkness. He wanted that same kind of religious sanction, divine approval for the Athenian navy, for the Delian League. So he took steps to get a titular hero, divine hero, to preside over the Athenian navy, and that was the hero Theseus. There was an island called Scyros, the dwelling place of pirates, south of the Strymon River, up in the northern Aegean, and it was reputed that on the island of Scyros were the bones of Theseus, that he had died on that island in his final years after being exiled from Athens, in spite of all the good things he'd done for the Athenians and killing the Minotaur and freeing the Athenians from the overlordship of the Cretan king Minos. His bones were on that island. And Cimon managed to get an oracle that said he should recover the bones of Theseus. So he used that as a pretext to attack the island and root out the pirates and kind of take it over and add it to the Delian League. And then he went looking for the bones of this hero, long buried, no one knew where. And finally he saw an eagle tearing at a mound of earth. It was probably trying to get a lizard or a snake out. And Cimon had a vision. He said, "That is the place, dig there." So they dug and they found the bones of a giant man buried there. He said, "These are the bones of Theseus." So with great pomp and ceremony, he had them loaded onto a sort of a catafalque. He had it carried in a great parade down to the shore and loaded on his flagship, his own trireme, and conveyed back to Athens in honor. And when it was taken to the city, they built a new temple to the god. Well, he is like a god. He's a divine hero, Theseus, the son of Poseidon. And a painter named Mikon was hired to put paintings on the walls of this temple that would show the myths of Theseus' life. And the one that had the most meaning, obviously, for Cimon was the one in which the boy Theseus, on his way to Crete, has dived into the sea and has met the queen of the sea, the goddess Amphitrite, and she is handing him a gold ring that used to belong to King Minos, the world's first thalassocrat, the world's first ruler of the sea. She's handing that ring to the boy Theseus to symbolize the passing of sea power from the ancient island of Crete to the new world of Athens. So in this way, Cimon is looking after the spiritual side of the Athenians and of their new naval enterprise, as well as the military side. Cimon loved the Spartans. He even named one of his sons Lacedaemonios, the Spartan. He thought the Spartans had the right idea. You should be active, vigorous, public-minded, always at the service of your city. He spent the years after he took over the command of the Delian League forces navalizing the Athenians in the same way that the Spartans had been militarized on a permanent, never-to-be-demobilized basis by the Messenian Wars. And this navalization went from top to bottom of Athenian society. At the top, every rich man in Athens was put on a list, and they rotated, taking it in turns year by year to be captains of the triremes. This was inescapable. There's never been a city like this. Venice itself, the Viking tradition, none of these included this kind of universal service on the part of the wealthy as commanders of warships. Yet the Athenians, after Cimon, took it for granted. Down at the other end, the lower classes are all now pulling the oars of the triremes. Instead of just doing it out of sort of public service to save their city as they'd done at Marathon and receiving just a daily stipend to cover their costs, they're now enriching themselves through this service. It takes 170 rowers to pull the oars of each trireme. Athens now has a fleet of 200. That's a lot of rowers. And they didn't use slaves. This is a modern misconception about the ancient world. They are combatants also, and fighting men are supposed to be free men. So at the oars of those Athenian triremes are the poor citizens of Athens, previously not quite disenfranchised, but never allowed to hold public service or be of importance in their city's government. Now they are what counts. 12 years after the Delian League began, Cimon learned that the great king Xerxes, now in his very last years, he had kind of retired to his harem and tried to forget the disaster in Greece. He had ordered his generals to mount another campaign against Greece. He also, I'm sure, had hoped for peace after the dreadful campaign of 84-79. Here were the Athenians and their Delian League allies continually harassing his territory. Something had to be done. He mustered, or told his generals to muster, a huge fleet, 350 ships by one count, 600 by another, at the mouth of the Eurymedon River, which is on the southern coast of Turkey near the modern city of Antalya. So outside the normal Athenian sphere of activity, they were going to bring a great fleet together there and a huge army, and they were going to repeat the invasion of 480, only this time they were going to win. Cimon heard about this. He put together a fleet of 200. He took them to this little Greek city called Knidos at the southwestern corner of Asia Minor, modern Turkey. Some of his ships were the veterans of Salamis 14 years before. They were kind of creaky and not so fast anymore. So what he did with them was to deck them over and pile his troops, many more than normally would have been on a ship, on those decks. Normal troop transports, the troops had rowed themselves, but he wanted the ships to still have a full complement of rowers so that they could be active in a sea battle, but at the same time carry a full complement of soldiers so they would act like troop transports and carry his army into the heart of the king's territory there in Asia Minor. They made their way along the coast. They took the Persians a bit by surprise there at the Eurymedon River near Antalya, because the Persians had not yet even gathered all of their forces. There were still 80 more Phoenician triremes expected at any time. And without any hesitation, Cimon swept down with his fleet on the mouth of the Eurymedon River. The Persians scrambled to launch their much larger fleet to meet him, came out, the two fleets collided, and such was the force of the Athenian charge, along with their Delian League allies, that the Persians very quickly broke ranks, turned for the river, tried to row up the river, found that they couldn't all squeeze into that narrow stream, abandoned their ships at the water's edge, and fled for a fortified position on shore. Cimon fought his way through the decks of the abandoned Persian ships, got on shore, headed up and beat their army at the fortified place, captured the navy and the army on the same day, a double victory the like of which had never been seen. And then, hearing about the 80 Phoenician ships that had arrived on the coast but were still a bit of a distance away, took some of the Persian ships he just captured, dressed his own officers as Persians, and went off and took those Phoenicians by surprise, who thought it was just the sort of Persian fleet coming to greet them, and the Athenians were already on top of them and in their camp before they could resist. This string of victories, like a string of firecrackers going off, lent a tremendous luster to Cimon's name. It was the climax of his career. He went back to Athens. He made a gift of, you remember Xerxes worshiping that beautiful plane tree, that sycamore on the road, the royal road. Cimon brought back these plane trees from Asia, planted them in the marketplace, the Agora of Athens, so it would look like the park of a Persian king, and then took the loot from the great battle at Eurymedon River, that climax of the Delian League's activities, gave it to the assembly at Athens, the Athenian share, and the Athenians took it and rebuilt the fortifications of the Acropolis itself, creating on the south side of that great rock a new retaining wall, still visible today, and preparing on the summit place for a new temple to the goddess Athena that would replace the ones burnt by Xerxes, that would show that Athens truly, thanks to Cimon and the efforts of all the citizens, had risen from the ashes.